From WXXI News, this is Connections, broadcasting from WEOS in Geneva. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made Wednesday morning at a press conference in Albany. That's where Republican leaders in the state assembly called on their Democratic colleagues to pass a couple of bills they say would strengthen oversight in state economic development programs. One of those Republicans was Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb. He says billions in taxpayer dollars are at stake, and he called New York's economic development programs broken, ineffective, even corrupt. Here's what you need to know about the bills. One would require state authorities to follow procurement rules to avoid pay-for-play type actions and give the state controller pre-approval power over certain projects. And the other bill is being called a database of deals and would require Empire State Development to create a database of projects where taxpayers could search the benefits and jobs produced by each project. The two bills passed by wide margins in the Senate, but it looks unlikely they're going to pass in the Assembly. There's a week of the session left, and Minority Leader Kolb is pushing his colleagues to act there and on other proposed measures as lawmakers head into the home stretch of this legislative session. And before that wraps up, Brian Kolb is taking a short break from Albany to join us here in beautiful, sunny Geneva. We're glad to be broadcasting from Finger Lakes Public Radio. And thanks for coming in. How are you?
I'm doing great. You're in the home of the 131st Assembly District. My district office is about a two-minute drive from here. And I've been representing Geneva and Ontario counties for 18 years, so it's glad to have you here.
I don't mind when you come to Rochester, but it's nice to come down to your digs.
It sure is, especially when the sun is out.
Well, there's a lot to talk about here, and listeners, as we go throughout the hour, we can entertain your calls and questions. Let's start with that economic transparency issue. First of all, when you say state economic development deals are broken, ineffective, even corrupt, is that too strong a word, or do you feel like that's pretty accurate?
No, and by the way, they're not just my words, Evan. These are descriptors that are made by good government groups throughout the state, by the state comptroller, Tom DiNapoli. The headlines have been prevalent for the last several years. You have the corruption trials. Joe Prococo, the closest aide to Governor Cuomo, who Governor Cuomo himself referred to as another brother of his family. You've got the Buffalo Billion that's going on trial soon. You got Elaine Calieros from SUNY Poly that's going on trial. The fact that the governor had received $400,000 in campaign contributions for a health care agency that got $25 million in taxpayer money. These are all the questions that are being raised, have been raised across the state. And the legislation we're referring to is basically trying to actually bring sunshine and sunlight and transparency to any deal that's done, regardless who's in the governor's office. Certainly the governor himself oversees all of the economic development programs, and his director, Howard Zemsky, and basically many of these decisions and deals are made unfettered, without transparency and openness as to, you know, what taxpayer money is being provided and what is the actual return for that investment.
Now, one of the bills, the Procurement Integrity Act, gets a 60-2 vote in the Senate, so it passes bipartisan almost unanimously. And from everything I'm reading, it can't even get out of committee in the Assembly. What is going on when it can be bipartisan and overwhelming in one branch of the legislature and not even move in the other?
Well, I'm going to say a couple things. First and foremost, if these bills come to the floor to the Assembly, they will absolutely pass overwhelmingly. No doubt about it. Both of these bills are sponsored by Assembly Democrats, not Assembly Republicans. These are Democrats that are in the majority. Assemblywoman People Stokes from Buffalo, Assemblyman Robin Scheminger from Buffalo, they're in the majority. They control the legislative process, the Assembly Democrats do. So they're not bringing their own bills out for an up and down vote. And so
why? What's going on?
Well, they're saying they're not sure. And what, not sure about what? I believe, I'm speculating that I believe that Governor Cuomo is leaning on Speaker Carl Hastie not to bring these bills out to the floor for a vote. And this goes on all the time in the state assembly where democracy stops. And these are two bills that have bipartisan support in both houses. You have State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli that believes these are the right bills to put in place. He's a Democrat. So this is all about trying to really change the way Albany operates in terms of using taxpayer dollars. And Governor Cuomo does not want these bills passed.
So when it comes to pay for play, that's a term that we hear in politics often, and I want to work through that in a couple of ways in terms of what you think it means. When you hear pay for play or you're concerned about pay for play for economic development, I think you referenced campaign contributions as one form of pay for play. What does that usually look like?
Well, what it usually looks like is, as we talked about this Crystal Healthcare Center, who really got a $25 million grant for a business that they didn't need, but the group of people made $400,000 in campaign contributions to Governor Cuomo's reelection campaign. That clearly, by any stretch of the imagination, is basically saying, we're going to give the governor some money. He's going to give us some money we really don't need or ask for, and that's what you call pay to play. When you're getting developers out in the Buffalo Billion who, if you will, assembled a variety of campaign contributions to Governor Cuomo's reelection campaign, and now all of a sudden they're in a no-bid process for literally hundreds of thousands of dollars of contracting work with no competitive bidding process, that's pay to play. And all of this directly comes back to Governor Cuomo's reelection campaign. This is how he operates. He basically, through others, leans on people to twist arms and to say, well, if you do a little business with me and my campaign efforts, I'll do a little business with you. Only the problem is he's using taxpayer dollars that it's unfettered and unchecked by the legislature or anybody else for that matter.
Okay, but every politician I've ever talked to just about will say, yes, you know, we get campaign contributions, but that would never color the way we legislate.
Well, I would say in general, with the legislature, I think that's pretty obvious because not one legislator has direct control over the release of public money, taxpayer funds. The governor does, and that's the difference. And certainly there's no rhyme or rationale to, you know, Governor Cuomo is a great spin artist, so he'll spin it anyway. And this is what happens in the media back and forth is, okay, Cuomo says this, Kolb says that, and there we go. Now we move on to another subject. Certainly, this is the problem. It's easy to dismiss with just a comment or a press statement from his press person. But I'm telling you, this is one of the worst forms of corruption that it does exist in this administration. And a lot of people won't talk about it because they're afraid of being intimidated back by the governor. He threatens people. He clearly is a bully. These are very serious problems that we have with state government. But unfortunately, in Albany, with the Albany press, they may do a story one day and they forget about it. This is what's wrong with Albany, and this is why taxpayers get fed up, because it's who you know basis in terms of state government, not necessarily what's the right thing to do.
Now, if money does impact policy, then how has it impacted you?
For me, it hasn't impacted me whatsoever. Do I have campaign contributors? Yes.
So you're like the one guy not impacted by it?
No, well, I think there's a lot of people that are not impacted by it. You know, people will write you a check. They're friends. There are people that believe in what you stand for. You know, I'm a pro-business guy. I'm less government. I'm for less taxes, getting rid of corruption, changing the whole process in Albany. And people say, well, to get you reelected, we want to contribute to your campaign because we believe in what you do. There's a lot of people like me in state government that do that, and local offices. But certainly then there are others. If you look at Shelley Silver, who's been arrested and convicted. You've got Dean Skelos, Republican, and others in state government that have been indicted for misuse of their office. And I think if there is public corruption, and the toughest thing with Governor Cuomo, to his credit, he's been smart enough to insulate him directly. In fact, he even uses a BlackBerry with his electronic transmissions because they can't be traced. They can't be detailed out as to what's being transpired on that BlackBerry. And that's why he uses it. And so I could point to a lot of good people that serve. It's expensive to run a campaign. But then you have to look at who has the ultimately direct control over being able to spend taxpayer dollars more freely. And that certainly is the governor versus anybody else.
Have you ever one time felt even pulled or questioned your decision making based on a contribution or an expectation of a donor?
No.
Not once?
Never.
Do you think this kind of corruption is bipartisan, equally bipartisan, though?
Yes.
You do. Okay. And if money can impact politics, do you support public financing of campaigns?
I will support public financing of campaigns if it's done fair and square. What's been proposed is not fair and square. There's been no limits in terms of public employee unions, the restrictions and what they can do. That there's a lot of what they do volunteer time, what they're getting paid for their jobs, that there's no accountability for that. There are groups that seem to be exempted from election law. There's political action committees that transfer money back and forth, what we think illegally. So my whole point is public financing sounds good, but part of the problem that they've used is that if you don't get enough the public contributing for a fund, the taxpayers have to make up for it. That's the part I don't support, is forcibly taking taxpayer money and saying you're going to publicly finance campaigns that you may not even philosophically agree with. So that's the hard part about public financing.
All right. And so before we move on to some other state business, if these bills are stalling right now, you only have a week left in the session. Is it your expectation that they're sort of dead deals this time around?
Well, that's entirely up to Speaker Carl Hastie and his conference. They've got 4 days, 3 days. And part of what we're doing today is what we were doing last week, is try to stimulate some public pressure to call assembly Democrats throughout the state and saying, and also, quite frankly, if they don't do anything, we will use these in the political campaigns this fall to point out that assembly Democrats did nothing when they had the chance to with bipartisan legislation that would help fix the corruption problem.
Okay, so you want people to call their lawmakers on this?
Especially assembly Democrats.
844-295-TALK if you want to call the program. Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb is our guest this hour, and we're broadcasting from Finger Lakes Public Radio, WEOS, our wonderful studios here, and we always appreciate having a chance to visit with Greg and Kelly and the outstanding team here. So we're down here in Geneva, but you can call the program no matter where you are. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And let's see here. There's about 100 things that are on state business we've talked about in recent weeks, but probably the most heated, or at least the kind of conversation that gets the most feedback, is on the subject of single-payer health care in New York State. It takes the form of an assembly bill that goes back to, I think, 1991, called the New York Health Act. It typically passes the assembly and then doesn't do much else. And there's a renewed effort by advocates to get that thing moving again on all levels of government this year. The New York Health Act, single-payer health care. You have never supported it. I don't expect that you've changed your mind.
Absolutely not. And it's simply put, the taxpayers cannot afford single-payer. It's been, shall we say, the narrative on the true impact of this bill has been biased. They've tried to sell it that this is going to provide better health care, less expensive health care for all of us. It's absolutely not true. They've done the experiment out in California. The cost is literally probably a quarter of $1 trillion that we certainly don't have, and certainly that the taxpayers, I don't think, can afford. As well as, I think, if you really ask the average New Yorker, the average taxpayer, do you think that New York State government is really good at running anything? And now you're going to put them in charge of a quarter of $1 trillion health care program that the taxpayers have to pay for? This is one of the greatest boondoggles I think I've ever seen in my time in the legislature. And out in California, this is where it sort of started. And now that they're realizing that taxpayers in California, well, it's hard to believe, are more liberal than the New York City liberals in this country. They're saying, wait a minute, hold on, we can't afford this. So we spent hours yesterday afternoon debating this bill on the floor, picking apart not just the negative points, but the points that absolutely make no sense. And Richard Gottfried, who's the sponsor, who's been in the assembly for over 40 some odd years, who's done nothing else in his career, basically stood up there and like didn't even blink about outright, shall we say, distorting the truth of all of the points that were being raised. And I sort of chuckle. If it isn't funny, it's sad that someone could really stand up there for 2 or 3 hours and really defend a bill that would break the backs of the taxpayer's wallet in New York State.
Well, I know he disagrees with you on that. He's been doing this for 27 years. You're right. He has been advocating for the New York Health Act or some form of single payer since 1991. And I think he would say he's proud of having a 3 to 4 decade career in which he's made this his main issue because he views the American healthcare system as having much worse outcomes for a lot higher cost than most industrialized countries. Do you disagree with that?
I would disagree with that, that this is not the worst healthcare system in the world. Do I agree with we have things to fix? Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. Well, it's not only a state issue, Evan, it's a federal issue. And you can see the dilemma when you have obviously the 100 United States senators and 400 plus U.S. representatives are finding a hard time to agree on what the correct remedies are that go back to when President Obama was president and carrying on, whether it's President Trump or whoever's going to be president, until they actually solve how do you balance all the needs and wants of 50 different states, because different states look for, shall we say, a very much more expensive, expansive program, such as California and New York and Illinois, which also happen to coincidentally be the same states that all have financial troubles. And so what I'm saying is single-payer health care is not the end-all. Are there things to fix? Absolutely. Does this bill do this? Absolutely not. It would cost the taxpayers so much money and not get the result. That's the two basic premises that we'll rail against. And I'm not saying anything's perfect in our state on healthcare or anything else, but this bill is not the answer.
Is there any version of healthcare, a change, an amendment, another system out there on the state level that is sort of palatable to you? Or you prefer status quo?
Well, I don't prefer status quo if there's anybody that's not getting quality healthcare. So, but I'm a business guy, Evan. What I do is say, okay, let's outline where the problems are, and let's then try to come up with a checklist of things that we could implement that make sense to cover any shortfalls or provide adequate health coverage to anyone that needs it. So, this is the problem with politics is you get into paragraph narratives and 30-second sound bites. And when you're talking about a multi-billion, trillion-dollar healthcare system in our country, you have to take a deliberative approach. You have to say, okay, what's our top problems? Let's go after those first. And then what are 2, 3, 4 different remedies that might do it? And that's where you got to try to find compromise. So what I'm trying to say is sometimes you got to take the political approach out and then really sit down and say, hey, we got a problem to solve. Now can we sit around a table and come up with a bipartisan approach to this?
Okay. And, you know, you're a young guy, but eventually you might be eligible for Medicare. And I wonder how you feel about single-payer Medicare, which is Medicare single-payer. Are you happy with what you see at the federal level with that?
Well, thank you for your kind words.
You
but
are.
If I wasn't currently employed, I'm eligible for Medicare right now. So
I am stunned at that.
I'm already there. I know I hide it well, but certainly I would go back to this, is that I'm a guy that show me the problem, and I think I can come up with at least some ideas on how to solve it. The problem is everything gets bogged down into partisan politics. That's what's wrong with Washington, and quite frankly, many times that's what happens in New York State, although I think it less happens in New York compared to Washington, but there's still too much partisanship in Albany as well.
It seems to like you think it has to have a bipartisan solution to not be political, but sometimes Republicans or sometimes Democrats just have bad ideas, right?
We both do.
So sometimes a solution is only going to be favored by one party. That doesn't make it inherently political or inherently worse, does it?
No, I think really the point is when you take down the attack barriers and it's more divisive and more, you know, in a terrible situation in Washington, and I blame both sides on this. I'm always a problem solver. I think that's what the general public expects elected officials to do, is solve my problems. That's why we're electing you. And I think the more you can do that, the more you can try to reach across the aisle. And we do that. I think we try to do that with the Assembly Democrats, even though they overwhelmingly have control of the chamber. When we have debates in committees, we offer suggestions on how to make their bills better, and sometimes they actually listen, which is great. Do I think that they should listen to us more? yes, but it's not because we're Republican. It's because we really think we have some better solutions. And I can tell you, there's a variety of bills both that are sponsored by assemblies, Democrats and Republicans, that never see the light of day because of the way the system is. And that's why I'm always advocating we got to change the system. We got to change how the place operates. We have to provide term limits to leaders and term limits to chairs. Richard Godfrey, I truly respect, but there's no person in this country that should be allowed to be a chair of a committee for as many years as he had. It's just his way or the highway with his committee. And to me, that's unacceptable. It can't be that way.
All right, let's talk about some other issues, because you just heard Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb say that he thinks he's, after many years in politics, got a pretty good sense for, show me a problem and I think we can come up with a solution, and hopefully not just a political solution, but a common sense solution. So let's talk about guns, let's talk about school safety. Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul recently made a stop at a high school during a bus trip around the state. She's trying to drum up support for what has become known as the Red Flag Gun Bill. It would allow police, school officials, and relatives of gun owners to petition courts to seize guns from people who have shown signs that they might hurt others. Do you support the Red Flag Gun Bill?
Absolutely not. It's a bad idea. And I say this, a bill was already passed earlier this March determining a group of people that might be eligible to notify the appropriate authorities that there could be a dangerous individual. That already exists.
So this is redundant? You don't need this law?
We do not need this law. Absolutely do not. It's a political election year ploy by Governor Cuomo. And of course, Kathy Hochul is lieutenant governor who's been ordered to go around and do this. I think using the backdrop of school kids and school buses, this is all about photo ops. We certainly have a concern over school violence. Well, a couple months ago, I had penned a letter to Governor Cuomo, and I said, I'm asking you, or our conference is asking you, to create a commission made up dealing with school safety of all the stakeholders that could be involved with a potential school shooting. And this is mental health professionals. This is law enforcement. This is the courts. This is teachers. This is school administrators. And I'm saying is put them in a room, no legislators, no politics, just get them in a room and say, start talking about New York schools and how we can look at trying to make our schools safer. And he's done nothing on that. There's a non-political remedy right there. I'm not asking for political appointments. I'm saying, Governor, you have the power to create the commission. Do this with the professionals and the stakeholders immediately that can look at all of our schools across the state. Right now, individual schools are taking their own steps to provide a safe environment. Unfortunately, in many cases, we have many schools that were built years ago that it's very expensive to retrofit from a security perspective. Down in New York City, there are young people going to school in trailers. And, you know, you look in upstate around our schools, even some of the older ones, these facilities are in pretty good shape. You go down to New York City, it's not so good. And so this is a comprehensive problem. It's an expensive problem, but a serious problem. And what's going on, Evan, this is about politics. This is about photo ops with the governor and the Red Flag School bill. And quite frankly, the way they've worded it and how certain language they left out, there's no reason to. If a teacher right now is concerned about a student and or his family or her family, and that they may be a danger or threat to themselves or the community, right now a teacher could pick up the phone and contact local law enforcement and ask them to look into it. So this is just about politics incurring. You know, there are people, obviously, in their state there's a lot of people. Everybody's concerned about school safety. But certainly this is not going to solve that problem.
All right. So let's do a couple things then, because Brian wants this commission and said the governor is not really willing to do that. It's a lot of political stuff. Let's right now create the first moment of that commission. So we're envisioning a big room, different stakeholders, et cetera. You get the floor first. And maybe a teacher says, Assemblyman Kolb, you've studied this issue. If Parkland or if Santa Fe had happened in New York State, our laws would be more under the microscope the same way that Florida and Texas's are. What is making schools safe or unsafe, and what's the first thing that should change in your view?
Well, First and foremost, what I would never do is get up in front of the room and say I'm the expert here.
Okay.
That's the problem. Governor Cuomo's no expert. He hasn't been to every school district and every school building in our state to be able to say, oh, this will help solve the problem. We have the SAFE Act, which if you talk to responsible, legitimate gun owners like myself, this law does nothing to make our streets safer. All it does is punish law-abiding gun owners, people that legitimately have the right to own firearms, which is all was done in the dead of night without public hearings, without public input, because it's all about politics. And my comment to you is that's the problem. We don't need politicians getting up in front of the room. We need to put people, even if you do it school district by school district, those same stakeholders, school district by school district, because every school is a little bit different. Every building's different. Point of entries are different. So this is not a slam dunk easy thing to do.
Okay, that's fair. But let me hit this a different way then. When you have freedoms, there are going to be consequences to those freedoms that are occasionally going to be tragic. If you let people drive cars, some will decide not to wear a seatbelt, and sometimes that decision will cost them their life. If you have if you allow people to drive cars at all in a society, sometimes there will be fatal accidents because someone will be sneezing or having a migraine or falling asleep. It's going to happen in a society. In the same way, if you have guns in a society, occasionally something bad is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I am not trying to be flippant or dismissive. I'm simply looking at, you cannot legislate away all risk. I think we agree on that, right?
Correct.
Okay. Are schools safe enough already? And is there a legislative solution for schools right now in your view?
In my view, a legislative solution is going to make everything safe? No.
Well, I don't mean everything safe, but things safer.
No. I don't think so, because if someone wants to commit a crime, if someone's hell-bent on using a firearm to kill somebody, there's motive and opportunity. Opportunity can exist. Even if you lock down the buildings, let's just say you can lock down every school building in this country, a person could sit outside the school property, see the buses pull up, and then disengage from their car on school property, just find their way, drive in the parking lot, pull out their weapon. We are all subject in a free society. It's not just about guns. It's about an entire freedom of movement in society that we're always at risk for somebody doing harm to each and every one of us. And sometimes they'll use a gun. And if you read the papers enough, you'll see someone using an automobile or a knife or explosives. Terrorists use explosives. That's their vehicle of choice. Some of the time they use firearms. So it's just the nature of the world that we're living in. And one of the things is I think that is also harmful is the absolutely the media goes crazy, which almost sometimes glorifies a shooter.
A mass shooting. Yeah.
And there are people out there who are saying, you know what, I'd like to, if I'm going to go out, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory and make all the newspapers. So when they see this, that's exactly what the media is going to do. I'm not saying this is the media's fault. I'm just saying these are the things that sometimes drive people to do bad things.
Well, I, as a member of the media, let me at least say, I think there's a debate about that and that the media at least needs to listen to what psychological experts say about the impact of either copycat behavior or inspiration based on possible notoriety. I don't know, and I'd like to spend more time thinking about that, but I'll at least give you that I think everybody's got a different role. On the legislative side, I take your point. I mean, people want to hurt somebody, they may be able to find a way to hurt them. Typically, your progressive friends are going to say that your attitude's too defeatist because if someone has access to sort of an arsenal of firearms, they can do more damage than they could do with other things, and that no one is saying take them all away or confiscate all guns, but simply throwing up your hands and saying, hey, free society, it's going to happen, it ignores the fact that it doesn't really happen in Japan or in parts of Europe where the laws are very different.
Well, I'm not a defeatist and I'm an optimist, and I certainly think that anything we can do to make workplaces safer, schools safer, I'm all in if it's common sense and doesn't erode the Second Amendment rights of every citizen in the state, law-abiding gun owners. This is the problem, that most of the actions that are taken are against law-abiding gun owners, not people that have mental health issues, not people that are criminals, not gang members. And that's the folks that really are most risk crowd of creating harm to people. So my point is, whatever efforts I think we do first, we focused on those areas first rather than law-abiding gun owners. I think that's the difference that I'm trying to illustrate, is that if we need more mental health professionals in our schools to help kids. In fact, I was talking with a well, I better not say what the school district was, but with a school district official the other day, and they were talking about how they're trying to be in touch with their students. If a student is exhibiting sort of a isolated behavior, head down, walking around the school, they try to say, well, does this particular student have friends? How let's meet, go meet with them. That, to me, was brilliant. Doesn't cost a penny. It just is about being attuned to your student population by the teachers and the administrators. I was blown away by it. And that's the extra step that they went to. There was a kid that was having drug problems. Same school district. Administrator, they did an intervention program, not only with the student, but with the parent. And they took a kid that was failing school, absolute drug user since he was 14, and literally turned this individual student around. But part of the winning formula was the parent said, you're right, we've got to do something. None of that has anything to do, but it's a prevention measure. And that's what we don't work enough on, is prevention.
All right, so last point on this, by the way, and on the subject of guns with Brian Kolb. You know, I'm thinking about a conversation I had with the chair of the Libertarian Party of Monroe County recently, who said, and other libertarians on the panel, who basically said, look, we are not Japan. We are not other European countries. Firearm ownership is a foundational right of this country. That's not going to change. It's not the same way in Japan and other countries where they don't really have gun deaths. And that if we're going to be intellectually honest, we accept that with more guns and more gun rights will come more gun death. And that that is a sacrifice we make for the freedom of owning guns. Is it simple enough? Would you agree with that?
I think that the premise I would agree with, yes.
That's what liberals, I think, generally don't agree with. Or they agree with that premise and they say, that's why it should change. We should take some of those rights away. Because we shouldn't accept more gun death.
And no. Now, see, there's a difference.
Okay.
No, we should not accept more gun deaths. But that's what they try to utilize.
I think they're saying it's inevitable if you allow this much gun ownership.
And I would disagree with that. I think that if you put forth common sense, preventive measures, more mental health professionals, making certain that the background checks are being done properly. Have you ever applied for a gun permit in New York State?
I have not.
Try it. Just try it and see how easy it is to get a legally owned firearm in terms of a handgun. And also, just like what happened with Judge Eustachio when she went tried to buy that shotgun. That's exactly how it should work, what they did in terms of when she tried to buy that shotgun. If people do what makes sense and common sense, Evan, not everything's going to go away, but those are the types of efforts I think we should put more effort on.
Okay, and before we get our only break, I'll tell our engineer back in Rochester, John Andrus. Hello, John. We'll get a break in a moment, and then we'll come back, and Keith and Victor, if you're still on the line, we'll grab your question. But John in Brighton wanted to know, would Brian Kolb support an assault-style weapons ban?
Right this second or after the break?
Hit that now. Go ahead.
Hit that now. I'm going to say that I would be open-minded to looking at the actual wording of the language, how it's done, accessibility. Does this exempt current owners of firearms? There's all sorts of questions I would have, so I just can't give a blank yes or no. Am I open to the discussion? The answer is yes.
Okay. Brian Kolb is the minority leader in the New York State Assembly, and he's our guest. We're broadcasting from WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM down here in Geneva. Let's get that only break, and we'll come right back to your phone calls with the minority leader next. Coming up in our second hour, it's all about bees. We're going to talk about colony collapse, the state of bees in Western New York, what we do and don't know about their disappearance. We'll also talk about how to recognize exactly what kind of bees you're seeing around your home, in your yard, and what you should and should not do about it. We'll answer your questions next hour as we talk bees on Connections. And welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Keith in Victor calling on line two with a question for Brian Kolb. Go ahead, Keith. Are you there, Keith? If you're there, I can't hear. Oh, there you are, Keith. Go ahead.
Are you there, Evan?
I'm here. Go ahead, sir.
Evan, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, I've got a couple questions for Brian. You said common sense. Would you support a elimination of a 30-shot magazine for a semi-automatic? Yes or no?
Well, the answer is I'm not familiar with that firearm, whether the 30, whether that's an AR-15, AR-13, something totally different. I am not a long gun automatic weapons expert. And so I can't even tell you right now I can visualize what that weapon is. So my comment to you is that I really don't know because I don't know the weapon and whether this is a normally legally owned firearm or not.
So in other words, if there are 30 shots available, you say maintain the access to purchasing a 30-shot magazine, but don't use common sense as it doesn't serve any other purpose.
No, well, let me ask you a question.
Nobody would target practice with it.
Is a 30-shot magazine legally able to be legally purchased today?
That I don't know. I was asking your opinion if you support the elimination of it.
Well, my point is I don't even know if it's legal now. So if you don't know and you're asking me a question and I don't know, I'm not trying to avoid common sense. It's just that I need to know whether that's a legally purchable stock right now. And if it's illegally available on the market today, would you say it shouldn't be? I would say no. As long as it's legally available, it should be continued to be unless we have some other change in the law.
Okay. You said you were a business person. Do you supply a service or a product?
I actually used to be in manufacturing, and we provided both service and products.
All right. Well, it makes no sense in this country why businesses have to incur the extra cost, especially when you make a product, of supplying health care for your employees when we compete on the world scale. We already have an inherently more expensive costs because we have to include the cost of health care. When you were, before you turned 65, and I'm assuming you have Medicare, you had health insurance, I imagine, through the state, and the taxpayers paid it, correct?
Actually,
high deductible?
I actually pay a portion of my health care costs. The state does provide a portion of my health care costs. And going back to when, because you started the premise on when I was manufacturing and in business and I owned my own business, and I'll be honest with you, I felt very strongly that employers, that one of the key benefits I think they should provide, or I always felt strongly about providing, was health care insurance for our employees as one of their benefits. And now that is going to may go against the grain at your point, why do businesses have to do it? Well, they don't have to do it, but I personally think it is a benefit that we should provide to our employees because I'm a very strong a believer in our employees are valuable assets to the business. They help make the business successful, and I want to do everything I can, as much as that I can afford, to help them, whether it's their salary or hourly wage compensation or their bonuses or their health care benefits. You're talking the wrong guy on that because I believe very strongly the more you can provide a competitive wage and health care benefit to our employees and personal time and sick time, I think that it makes a happier employee, their families happier, and they'll make a much more productive employee and dedicated employee long term.
Well, I agree with you to a point where you said the health care. Health care shouldn't be an employee responsibility. It should be the responsibility of the federal government to make sure have health care. I'm in full favor of a single payer because, you.
All right, Keith, we're losing you. So John, we're going to have to lose that call just because we're losing the quality of it. But let me continue on Keith's thread with Herman's email. I'm sorry, with Dan's email. Brian, I think you said earlier that you don't want government making large-scale healthcare decisions. You're not a big truster of government in this way.
That would be correct.
Okay. So yesterday on the program, we called back to the late George Carlin, who liked to tell people, if you don't like government, you don't like yourselves because you're the people who elected these guys. So start blaming yourself. The government is just you. Here's Dan emailing the following. We'll see what you think. He says, I get Mr. Kolb's skepticism about government's ability to function, but being philosophically opposed to public or governmental approaches is an anti-public or at least a self-loathing conflicting sentiment, isn't it? If we the people decide who makes up the government, then isn't being a hardline pessimist about the function of government essentially being a hardline pessimist about ourselves? What gives?
I love people that like to just throw out name calling and they think they're doing you a favor by calling me a pessimist. Anybody knows me personally, I am the optimist, not a pessimist. What I am is I do challenge the status quo. Do I challenge when things could be better? Absolutely. This is my mantra. I don't believe in labels. I believe in getting results. That's the way I've operated since I've been first brought up by my parents helping out in their business when I was 11, 12 years old. And so to me, this is about this is what typically is done. You finger point out, you're a pessimist, you don't believe in government. Yes, I believe in government. I wouldn't be serving in government if I didn't believe it. I'm just saying that the way government currently operates, you can't trust them to put a system together that really, really works based on the current structure of government in Washington and Albany, which is too politically driven. And yes, we have political parties, but once you get elected, my philosophy is you should be sitting down with Republicans, with Democrats, with conservatives, with blanks, and figure out, you know, what's the best solution to the problems that we're running into. And that's when I served on a town board, when I served on a school board, and when I served on the county board of supervisors right here in Ontario County. Quite frankly, the men and women, both parties, generally did that premise. Let's work together to figure out how we can make our town, school board, and county better. When you get to Washington, when you get to Albany, and you got all these diverse interests, you got special interests knocking on the door, it becomes harder to do that. That's why I believe that you've got to have more of a pragmatic approach to these huge problems rather than just saying government can solve it all.
We're here in Geneva at WEOS at Finger Lakes Public Radio, and Brian, at the heart of Brian's district, you know the issue well, the debate on Seneca Lake over an incinerator project run by a company called Energy. They have said that it is good for the environment. It is a smart way to take care of trash. It is a job creator. A lot of the opposition, and the opposition comes from a lot of different quarters, has said in the middle of a bucolic agricultural tourism region, the last thing you want is a huge trash incinerator in which we're burning New York City's trash. So I'm trying to sum up as fairly as I can both sides, but I know it's complex, and I want to know how you feel about the debate over that project and what you think the weight of your office should do about it.
Well, first and foremost, this was brought to me by a constituent back in, I think, the fall of 2017, and my immediate answer was I would be opposed to having a trash incinerator located at the Seneca Depot in the heart of the Finger Lakes region. I'm opposed to it. I've been outspoken about it. I've joined together with our regional delegation, Senator Pam Helming, Assemblyman Phil Pomisano, to absolutely speak out about locating this particular incinerator in the heart of the Finger Lakes. The Finger Lakes is one of our greatest natural resources and tourism attractions. The growth of wine and beer industry in our area, which boosts tourism, wrong place, and I am not convinced that this is environmentally safe. My whole point is, okay, let's just set this aside on the burner for the Finger Lakes right now. Why don't we take that incinerator and locate it somewhere in the boroughs of New York City? And we'll see how popular that is in the boroughs of New York City. And not only that, let's put the second one somewhere in Long Island first. So we could have two incinerators right now in the five boroughs so they don't have to ship garbage to the Finger Lakes region, to the landfills, or to an incinerator. And the same thing with Long Island. Or better yet, let's locate an incinerator in the city of Buffalo, city of Rochester, city of Syracuse, city of Albany, and let's see how all those people feel about the sanctity and environmentally safe trash incinerator being in their communities. When you prove all those areas safe and sound, let those incinerators run 5 years, test the air and water before and after, then maybe we'll talk about the Finger Lakes.
All right. So it sounds like I know your opinion, but do you think that project still has hope to move forward?
I have no idea. One of the things that we're doing right now is we've introduced legislation, co-sponsored legislation we're hoping to take up for a vote this week, basically saying that we have to have local input. Right now, the power plant or siting law precludes having local input. And so what we're saying, we believe the folks in the Finger Lakes area should have the ability to weigh in. And I know the local officials have, Seneca County has, the towns in Seneca County, I think even other surrounding areas have already weighed in, elected officials, and say, we don't think that this is good for our region. Now, Governor Cuomo right now has said he doesn't think that we should do this, but you know, the DEC, we're not really sure where they stand, and certainly a lot of question marks.
Do you think fracking will ever be brought back as an issue for this region?
I don't think so.
Should it be?
In the Finger Lakes region, no.
Okay. A couple more questions from listeners. Let me get to the question from the listener about the Sunshine Bill. Okay. Maxine in Rochester wanted to know, does Brian know the number assigned to the bills we talked about economic full disclosure earlier this hour? She says if she's going to call her legislator, she'd like to know the number of the bills. She said it was something like the Sunshine Law.
I don't know the numbers off the bill, or the bill right off the top of my head, because I don't have it in front of me.
One of them is known as the Procurement Integrity Act. So there you go. That's the first. There's two of them, right? And the second one, I've got somewhere in my pile of notes. Oh, the second one is about a database of bills. Okay.
Does it list in the release the under, it's People Stokes and Robin Schimminger, it's an A?
Oh, I don't have that. We're going to see if we've got it somewhere in this pile. Do you think we do, Megan Mac? We do. Oh, there we are. Okay, so the Assembly Bill is A, 5657. Okay? So there you go. And I don't know about the second bill. But there you go, Maxine, if you call your legislators.
And my comment is, if you you can call my office in Albany, 518-455-3751, 518-455-3751, and they can give you both those bill numbers, and then you can contact your legislator.
Okay. John wants to know, does Brian support punishing gun owners whose guns are used in mass shootings, such as the father of the Parkland shooter who gave access to guns?
What I'm going to say to you is that whatever the current existing law is should be enforced. So if there is no provision in law, is a firearm been stolen? Did someone take a safe? Did someone break the lock? Those are all extenuating circumstances we have no answers for. My point is, whatever the law currently calls for, I would support.
What is the most pressing issue that the legislature is not doing right now or taking up? What is frustrating you the most out of Albany? You've got 4 days left in the session. And if this doesn't get done, you're going to be the most frustrated. What is it?
Oh, boy. The list is somewhat endless, depending upon the final solution of the session. But one of the things that's always frustrated me for years is Brittany's Law. It's a registry for violent offenders. And basically, it's just that those that have been convicted of a violent crime against another person to put their name on a database and a registry that can be communicated to the general public across the state. It's called Brittany's Law, based on the stabbing deaths of a mother and father right here in Geneva, New York. And certainly this bill, just to create a registry, just to let people know out there that there are violent offenders in their community, has passed overwhelmingly 5 or 6 years now in the state Senate, bipartisan support, upstate legislators, downstate legislators, Republicans, Democrats. And again, just like these transparency bills, the Assembly Democrats, with an Assembly Democrat sponsor, and this is key, this is not a Republican bill, although I co-sponsor it. These are bills where I get frustrated that just sit there. In fact, there's another bill that I wish I could give you the details on, but I'll certainly send them to Evan that he can share with you next week. There's a bill in the Assembly that has got over 100 out of 150 co-sponsors that the leadership of the Assembly Democrats will not bring forth to up and down vote. And it's a very, very sad story. And the only reason I'm not going to piecemeal it, because I want to give Evan the facts that he can recite them, because I wasn't prepared to talk about it today, but I'll provide that information.
All right, down to our last minute. I just want to say that we did see a note from the Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and they don't support Brittany's Law. They say that the bill would not serve as a deterrent for criminals, and it might put victims at a greater risk of retaliation. And the registry would only help identify a small number of domestic violence offenders. What do you say to that?
I think that's totally bunk. I really do. Certainly, the point being, it's the same thing with the sex offender registry. It's knowledge. So, for instance, the whole point of having it, it's not about going after innocent people. This is about convicted violent felon, people that have a higher percentage of recidivism, and that is harming someone else. So my point is, you've got a sister or aunt or whatever, mom, even dating again, and you say, you know, there's something kind of odd about this guy, and I'm going to just go online and see if he's on this registry. If nothing else, maybe that individual may not know about it, but a family member or a friend or a community member. And it's just about, hey, we're not going to, you know, put a march out there against this particular person. It's about public knowledge. And as far as I'm concerned, once you've committed a violent act against anybody, I think you lose that right of anonymity going forward.
Brian Kolb is the minority leader of the New York State Assembly, one of the most accessible lawmakers and generous with his time. We ask him to come to Rochester, he comes to Rochester. We ask him to come to Geneva, that's easy. This is the heart of your district. But thank you for always saying yes and for being here. We always appreciate the conversation.
My pleasure.
That's Brian Kolb. We're broadcasting live from WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio in Geneva today. Short break, more connections coming up.